not coming. I'm just...
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, everybody. Welcome. As we are located in Montezuma Hall on the SDSU campus, I wish to first acknowledge the fact that this event is taking place on the occupied territory of the Kumeyaay people. And I wish to acknowledge the many indigenous peoples who have loved this land for thousands of years before the Spanish and other European colonists seized it. So, my name is Mark Wheeler, and I'm the chair of the Department of Philosophy here at SDSU, and I'm the director of the Institute for Ethics and Public Affairs, and I'm grateful to all the people who helped make this event possible. I'm certainly honored to have the opportunity to be on stage with Dr. Daniel Ellsberg. Like Sojourner Truth, Henry David Thoreau, Susan B. Anthony, Harvey Milk, Dolores Huerta, Dan has demonstrated that he is a courageous citizen, willing to risk life and limb for his moral ideals, conscientious as a soldier, and conscientious in his acts of civil disobedience. I'll be asking Dan a series of prepared questions. For the first hour or so, we'll be having give and take up here, mostly give from Dan. I'll be taking. And then we'll open it up for questions afterwards. We're going to privilege students first, but then the hope is that other people have a chance. Can you hear me? Very good. So first question, now that we have a clear understanding of the circumstances that precipitated and prolonged the Vietnam War, has your position on and thinking about American policy in Southeast Asia in the period between 1945 and 1975 changed? Yes.
Can you hear me?
No.
You really know. But they can hear me. Can we mic up on Dan? It's on.
Wait, let's try again.
Maybe this is wrong. See that one.
Glad I asked. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
It just occurred to me for the first time 40 or 50 years ago that a friend of mine was an Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence at that point, Roger Hilsman, who had fought guerrillas, as a guerrilla, against the Japanese in the Second World War, and thought that we had the ability to use counter-guerrilla tactics, short guerrilla tactics. He applied that. He'd been in Burma, as a matter of fact. But remember, he and others in the army, because he had been in the army, but people who were in the army in 65, when he was in the Assistant Secretary, used to say, we have to be able to deal with this the way we dealt with the Indians. And indeed, you know, they thought it was Indian fighting.
That's right.
No one wants to hear me.
hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when I wasn't practicing piano as a kid, I was seeing cowboy movies and whatnot, and they're the same pretty much up until quite recently. You're always identifying, of course, with the cowboys who are shooting the Indians. As somebody who in the Marines had to learn to fire a 45 and did learn because of my pride, I know that to begin with you don't qualify. When you see people on horseback knocking off people like this, you know, somebody who's been trained with a pistol knows that doesn't happen. You don't shoot people. But who were they shooting? They were engines off their horses. And the idea, the only good engine is a dead engine. Actually, how many people have actually heard that phrase? Okay, well, it's still, I don't know if kids now would ever hear that from our history. But of course, if we've read about African Americans, Asian Americans, whatnot, who would be in the audience and now reflecting back on that and saying, gee, with my buddies, I was led to cheer those cowboys, and then I thought, wait a minute, you know, that's me up there that they're shooting at. And the idea that these savages, asymmetric warfare, right? The artillery was on our side, the cap, but they had their bows and arrows, or they had some guns and whatnot. But we were wiping them out. The military was coming over the hill and saving everybody from the engines. And that's the way we would do it in Vietnam, where every little post was a little fort. And as a matter of fact, I'll mention the history of Vietnam came in this way. I began to get a sense of what we were dealing with over there in the course of a couple of years of going to nearly every province in Vietnam, 43 provinces. I traveled in 38 of them. And in one in particular, I remember going through something that was almost like an archaeological dig, looking at different books. You would see a popular forces little fort against the Viet Cong, supposedly the Vietnamese communists, who were after all, their cousins, you know, their brothers, perhaps, whatever. But anyway, those Vietnamese. And our Vietnamese had these little forts. And then you'd go on a little further, and you'd see a concrete pillbox. And that was a Japanese pillbox from World War II, when the Japanese had occupied it. Then you'd see French forts. And finally, I remember very particularly, you saw a large mound of earth covered with grass, and that was a Chinese fort. And I remember two things from that period. A Vietnamese colonel was traveling with me, and there were kids coming out, you can see where the stairs are going, asking for gum, saying, hey, okay, hey, American number one, from 1 to 10, you know, 1 is very good. And saying, hello, Americans. And the Vietnamese said to me, when I was a kid, I used to yell at soldiers too, coming along. And I said, what did you say, bonjour? You know, the American French were there for 100 years. And he said, no, not sayonara, but the other said, what's good morning in Japanese? Ohio. Yeah. He said, oh no, I called Ohio. And as a kid growing up from 10 to 14 in the war and seeing those newsreels, I can say that made my hair shiver, that we were walking in the feet, not just of French, but of Japanese. That was very eerie, uncanny. We were invaders, just as we are in Afghanistan or Iraq or other places today, and are being fought in much the same way. A Vietnamese friend of mine actually said to me once, you have to understand of us, we're people who think of ourselves as having defeated the Chinese, though it took us 1,000 years. And I thought, oh. We're working on a different time scale here. Well, let me make a... So I came to realize we had no more right to be killing Vietnamese in that country than the Japanese had ever had, or the French had ever had. They were seeing us in the same shows, rightly so. We were in the same area. It took me a long time to realize that, because I came over there thinking, we are the big brothers. We are helping Vietnamese from other Vietnamese. from, we're helping them, we're protecting them from communism. And we're helping, and many, many soldiers who went, troopers who went over there, were very puzzled. They weren't treated in a very friendly, you know, very friendly way by people. They couldn't understand. We're here, they didn't associate the fact that we were bombing them, you know, constantly at the same time. And then handing out candy, which we did do, was fine, and little boys liked that a lot. But it really didn't compensate for the fact that we were bombing their villages at the same time.
So
I didn't realize, in other words, that we were invaders in the same sense, that we had no right to be there and doing it, we were kidding ourselves on the myth of our actual role in that country.
I want to ask a follow-up here. Since the materials have been released and all the archival materials have been released, is there any one revelation that has profoundly changed the way you now think about the conflict?
That I think?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you mean from the Pentagon Papers, or is the material that came out since?
Since, yeah.
Oh, yes, actually, my friend Larry Berman and I were giving a seminar this afternoon here, and I paid tribute to it, that his book changed my thinking, his book called Planning a Tragedy. It was a tragedy, I guess. There are other words that could be used, like criminal aggression, that sort of thing, murder, that sort of. But anyway, it was a tragedy, yes. And but his book is extremely good. And it introduced me to the fact of the very period that I had been in the Pentagon, reading what I thought was essentially everything on Vietnam. But he revealed to me that there was material that had been withheld from me at my high grade. I was a GS-18, which was the highest civil service grade at that time. And I thought I had access to just about everything there. But there was a file that I had not had access to, and Larry had been declassified, and Larry was one of the very first to present it. And what I realized was that Lyndon Johnson had been given advice that was as wise and foresighted and prescient, and recommendations that were as good as he could have gotten, far more than enough to keep a president out of Vietnam, from his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who could judge the politics of this as well as Lyndon Johnson could, and who told him in 65 that if he went in, which he hadn't yet done with troops and bombing, he would have the same fate as the French. He would, 3 years from then, facing nomination, he would be stalemated in a costly and escalating war, and he might be denied nomination, which he was. There would be a split in his own party, not in the Republicans, that would keep him. So it was this political advice that was extremely good. But then Lord Clifford, who had practically alerted, invented the Cold War under Truman, way back in 47, 48, was now a counselor to another president, to Lyndon Johnson, and was saying, I see nothing ahead but catastrophe for my country. He says, the Russians and the Chinese do not intend for us to lose, for to win this war. And the Vietnamese do not intend to give up. He said an amazing thing, as a matter of fact. This is before we had sent any, no, I take it back. Clifford was saying this in July of 65, as he contemplated putting another 100,000 troops in Vietnam, in addition to the 100,000 we had already authorized. The Humphrey statement was even before we sent any troops. And so now it's a question of, we had 100, should we send another 100, which McNamara was my Secretary of Defense, was recommending. And opposing that, in front of Johnson, Clifford said, 500,000 troops, 50,000 dead, that is not for us. But it was for us. In 1968, we had 550,000 troops there. Before we left, we had lost 58,000 dead and killed several million Vietnamese. That was a fairly uncanny figure to have given, 500,000, 50,000 dead. And yet, the president went ahead. So what I'm saying is that gave me a puzzle that said, wait a minute, my whole understanding of this is turned around by that. Those documents, and they weren't alone. Berman brought up, George Bundy, Bill Bundy, others, that were all saying, don't do this. But the Joint Chiefs said, do it. And Johnson, against his own better judgment, went with the Joint Chiefs.
Let me ask you a question that's based on Larry Berman's work, Professor Berman's work. So Larry has argued that in the aftermath of the overthrow of South Vietnamese President Thieu Nguyen Yen, in November 1963, the United States effectively owned South Vietnam on account of its role in abetting the coup. So for Berman, this sort of represents the point of no return in our policy. Looking back now, what do you think the biggest lost opportunity was for avoiding direct U.S. military intervention in Vietnam? If any, if there was a lost opportunity.
Okay, it's very close to what Larry is saying, but actually there's a significant difference in my own mind. I heard him say that this afternoon, and I didn't have time. I was saying so many other things, and so I didn't have time to take issue with him on that one, but I will mention it now. In effect, to say that the assassination of Diem made what came later inevitable is, I think, mistaken, actually, in the following sense. That happened under John F. Kennedy. It preceded Kennedy's assassination by a few weeks, actually a couple of weeks. Had Kennedy lived, I don't think we would have owned Vietnam, as I did go on to great length this afternoon, as Larry knows, but I think on that I've written it in my books. I believe that JFK, Jack Kennedy, was determined to get out of Vietnam, but not before the election of 64. And he thought, as he said to Kenny O'Donnell and to Senator Mansfield, if I get out now, I will be damned as an appeaser, weak on communism, and I could not go into the election that way, even against Goldwater, who would be denouncing him for that reason, or really any other Republican, Nixon, Rockefeller, whoever. But he said, as soon as the elections are in 65, we get out. And he could have done it, I think, with a conference of the kind that de Gaulle was proposing at that time. As Bobby Kennedy said to me, when I said, were you really prepared to lose it? He said, quote, we would have fussed it up. We would have gotten in, quote, we would have gotten in a government in Viet Sang, which would have been easy from one day to the next, that asked us out, or we would have called for an international conference that de Gaulle is proposing, that the British want, and others, like the Geneva Conference of 54, and they would make an arrangement for, you know, evolution there that would give us an out that would disguise the fact that we were getting out. That's what he said. And I believe, I asked him, by the way, whether he really thought that Kennedy would have carried that out in 65, had he lived. He said, I can't know that. And he said, Jack couldn't know that for sure. But I do know what his intention was. And that was not to send any combat troops. Because had we done that, he said, my brother was convinced that we would go the way of the French, which is what Ball was later saying 2 years later and others. And it was true. That was what happened. And I was so impressed that he had no combat troops. We could go the way of the French because, by the way, we didn't pay, it was very rare to pay any attention to what the French had experienced in Vietnam. As was often said, they only survived two world wars because we saved them. They're the French, they're incompetent, fraud, you know, so forth. And this was, believe it or not, it was very commonly said, they're racist, unlike us. So, and we have helicopters and so forth. So for him to even pay attention to the French experience was very different. I don't, by the way, believe that there is a sentence in the Pentagon Papers, in 7,000 pages, in which any other politician made that statement, a comparison. Certainly not Lyndon Johnson. I'll bet the word French did not appear in his mind. But had he lived, so he said, but I do know what his intention was. And I'll just say what I said this afternoon. I asked, when I said, gee, that's awfully foresighted, you know, for This was now 67, I'd been in Vietnam for 2 years. How did Kennedy reach a judgment like that as a young man? And I said, what made him so smart? And he said, I jumped. And like that. And he said, we were there in 1950. We saw what was happening to the French, and we knew what would happen to us. My brother was determined that it would not happen to us. I believe he intended to get out, and he could have easily done it with a conference. And he had at that time people in Congress, Senator Russell, Senator Folk, Mansfield, majority leader, Senator Church, and others who wanted to get out. No political problem. He could have done it, but he was killed. He did not. As you said to Kenny O'Donnell and Mansfield, we better win the election. Well, he didn't. He didn't win. It was Johnson who was not prepared to lose an election. And not, I'm sorry, war. And not to be the first person to lose a war, first president, even if, and this was very paradoxical for this politician, I think even if, as Humphrey estimated, it put his election in risk, I think he was more prepared to risk his election as a winner, as somebody who was trying to win unsuccessfully, than to win an election and be called a loser in Vietnam by Nixon and Goldwater and Robert. And his Texas friend, who told him, one of them said, Lyndon, Texans will forgive a lot of things, but they won't forgive losing a war. And that kept five presidents in a row in there at the cost of any number of Vietnamese lives. So, as I say, I had one understanding of the war till I read those documents. And then no other book had as much effect on me until just months ago I read Pierre Asselin's account in Vietnam's American War of the Hanoi end of this, and learned for the first time that Lai Xuan, who I virtually never heard of, had displaced Ho Chi Minh in 64, and Vo Nguyen Xiap, the general of Dien Bien Phu, put them aside. They did not want to draw the Americans in. That was wisdom. But Lai Xuan, a tough communist leader, displaced them, went ahead to the offensives of 64 that did bring us in, thinking that he could beat our Arvin puppets before the Americans got in. Wrong. And then once the Americans were in, he prepared the Tet Offensive, expecting a general uprising. Wrong. 50,000 Vietnamese dead on his side, against Ho Chi Minh's advice and Vo Nguyen Xiap's advice. Then, again, in 72, let's beat them again with an offensive before, with the Americans not, won't be willing to bomb us, our troops, and to stop it. Another 50,000 lost. Disaster, which I learned from Asselin's book. The decision-making under Lai Xuan in Hanoi was as bad as the decision-making in Washington and by Westmoreland. And for that, millions of people died.
Well, on that optimistic note, let's turn to your recent book titled The Doomsday Machine, which is an important book, and I hope everyone here has a chance to read it. And in the book, you recount your work as a nuclear war planner. And you argue in the book that longstanding U.S. policy for the nuclear weapon is profoundly immoral and horrendously evil. I wonder if you could briefly recapitulate your argument for this and offer us some advice about how to improve this policy going forward.
Okay, I don't think any president has wanted a nuclear war, small or large. But every president since Harry Truman has wanted to be able to threaten nuclear war and has wanted to prepare for it for a lot of reasons, including Boeing, Lockheed, North American, Grumman, and whatnot, who depend on government contracts and that preparation. And that is true today. For example, let me jump right up on something that is actually quite amazing. Just last week, we were involved in refueling. We've sent 3,000 sorties in Yemen, refueling Saudi planes that are bombing mostly civilians, creating a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, which the UN has described as a humanitarian catastrophe that can get worse. A breakdown in their infrastructure by the bombing that we have supplied, the planes, the bombs, and we refuel the planes on that. So we're totally involved in it. We're not just supporting it. On Yemen. By the way, how many Americans would find Yemen on a map? But anyway, that's what we're doing. We've been doing it for 7 years. A million people are suffering from cholera, the biggest cholera epidemic, they say, in history. And this is going on day by day. What's new is some release of documents last week or so, which lie behind the decision by Secretary of State Pompeo to certify that we can support the Saudis in this because they are improving their treatment of civilians, their discipline, and it is acceptable, a level of discipline. What came out recently is that every agency in the State Department, this was leaked, so last week, you can look it up, by the way, very easy, State Department documents on the internet. Every agency resisted that, and said there is no progress, there is no basis for accepting this, you should not certify this. It's false, and it's wrong, you shouldn't do it. Except one, the Legislative Affairs agency in there. And Pompeo went with the Legislative Affairs, which is what, and the reason given in the State Department documents is, if we don't support the Saudis on this, it will put into jeopardy a $2 billion contract from Raytheon. This is in the documents. You don't see this connection made very obviously recently. It struck me between the eyes. A Raytheon contract for precision-guided missiles to the Saudis, and beyond that, our general arms sales to the Saudis, which may be $10.5 billion, and the President, Trump, has talked about $100 billion sales of arms to the Saudis. And the immediate contract is a $2 billion Raytheon contract, and for that he certified that the attacks are to continue against the urging of the UN Commission on Human Rights. It so happens that the head of the Legislative Committee is a man who was recently, until recently, a lobbyist for Raytheon. Now, coincidence, that's pretty bold, but I'm saying that lies, I think, more than is in my book. I focus more on this in the last year, it so happens. I've been reading other books and other papers. I think I've neglected this feature for a long time. But you were saying in the book opens with this incident, which, I wrote a question for, actually, the Secretary of Defense, but it was picked up by the President's assistant, Robert Comer, the Deputy Assistant for National Security, to send to the Joint Chiefs in the President's name, John F. Kennedy, in the spring of 1961. And the question to the Joint Chiefs, which I won't go through the whole story, but I tell it in the book, but I mistakenly believe they did not have a quick answer to this question, and I thought it would embarrass them bureaucratically, and we could go on from there. And the question simply was, if our war plans are carried out as planned, they don't go awry, they aren't preempted by the Russians, whatever. If you carry out and hit the targets you want to hit, planned, how many people will die? I first asked, in the Soviet Union and China, knowing, by the way, that our plans had no provision for a war with Russia that did not also obliterate China. No plan for just Russia, USSR. Well, they did have an answer. And I'll leap ahead here because that led me to ask another question, which we got a week later. How many altogether And that total was 600 million. 600 million. 325 million in the USSR and China alone, 100 million in East Europe from our attacks on airfields and air defenses, 100 million in West Europe, our allies, from radioactive fallout from our own strikes without a single warhead of ours landing over there. And finally, 100 million in areas contiguous to the USSR and China, like Afghanistan, India, Austria in Europe, neutral areas like that, Finland, Japan, not neutral, but so forth. 600 million altogether from our strike. Now, that did not include Russian retaliation, which turned out at that time would have been very small against the US. It turned out that rather than the 1,000 ICBMs that the commander of Strategic Air Command was estimating the Russians had, 1,000, that was in August of 61, a month later, the estimate came in from our conclusive satellite photography, 4. Not 1,000, but 4. So they wouldn't have hit any of us, but they would have annihilated every last European. So Eurasia, from Portugal to China, obliterated, including our allies, and also, you know, nearly all civilian. I thought of that as the most evil plan that had ever existed. And it was done by people that I was daily in contact with, colleagues. I was drinking beer with them, like Brett Kavanaugh. So in the evening we were drinking beer in the Pentagon, or not in the Pentagon, but outside. These were ordinary guys, family guys, very recognizable, ordinary people, and ordinary Americans. And I was sure that was true in Russia too. And yet they were capable somehow of obediently carrying out plans that had this implication. And I would say that changed, that put questions in my mind about the human species that had not been there before, and which have stayed with me ever since. And so when I say, your question was, how did you put it, that it was insane and immoral. Well, what other words are to be used for this? Revealing to me at 87 now, I know that very people were not just ordinary intelligence, but smart, very smart, can be stupid in certain areas, and back even crazy plans. Crazy plans. This was crazy, and it is crazy. That option, we are prepared to do that right now, and have been all along, including ever since the Cold War ended. We lost the Warsaw Pact, admittedly. We lost the USSR in existence, and still we are reproducing what I call a doomsday machine, a system that's capable of ending nearly all life on Earth. And the way it does that is in a, we'll come back to that, but in a, I'll just mention it now, in terms of an effect that we didn't even know in 61 for another 20 years, 40 years into the nuclear era, what's called nuclear winter, if you come back to that. But freezing temperatures on the Earth's surface caused by the fires produced in cities by our attacks that would loft smoke from the fire into the stratosphere where it would blanket the Earth, I am going to, blanket the Earth so quickly and so completely for a decade, it wouldn't rain out in the stratosphere. It would produce ice age conditions on the surface of the Earth and kill all harvests. And nearly everyone would starve. The scientists tell me not everyone, probably not full extinction from this alone, although the ozone problem might finish everybody off. But from this effect, some people in the southern hemisphere, in Australia and New Zealand, eating mollusks and fish would survive. And if it was 1%, that's now 70 million people. That's a fairly large number of people. But 99% gone, civilization gone. So they say, no one wants this to happen. No one would recognize this as anything but something that transcends words like immoral, killing everyone, is that immoral? You know, it's really, you don't have concepts to deal with this because it wasn't possible until the last half century. But it is possible now, and we continue to print, and both the U.S. and Russia are spending over $1 trillion in the next 30 years, 1.7 trillion they figure in our country, to reproduce this capability now that it's somewhat aging. I call that immoral and insane.
Dan, you've been on the inside, you've worked on this for years. You've thought about it. In the book, you make some suggestions. But could you say a little bit about what you think we should do to change the planet? How can we do it? The other night when we were at dinner and we were talking about the problems of the practical implementation of this vision, it'd be interesting to hear what you have to say.
Okay, there's a number of proposals. And let me, right now, I have a hopeful feeling about this for the first time. And I've always thought we needed a movement like the anti-war movement or like the freeze movement 35 years ago, roughly, which aimed only at freezing the level at that time, which did not occur. We've been modernizing weapons ever since. But we haven't seen any movement since then. And I didn't see any prospects of it. And I haven't until weeks ago, this is quite coincidental in a way. If I'd given this talk a month ago, I wouldn't have been able to tell you what I'm about to say. If you look on your website, for the website preventnuclearwar.org, preventnuclearwar, one word, .org, you'll find, come to a campaign called Back from the Brink. And its subtitle is Preventing Nuclear War. And it has a call for 5 points, specifically, to lower the risk of nuclear war, sharply, which I think is a very good program. And it's actually pretty much what's in the last chapter of my book. It's the same agenda. I was not aware that anybody was pressing this agenda or that there was any real prospect of getting a campaign. There's not even damp tinder. There's just nothing there. And surely there's lots of other things to worry about that are getting attention. Climate, this is getting a lot of attention. And there's even a movement. We can't say that's sufficient, can we? Because with a president and a Republican Party in power that deny the existence of man-made climate change, we're not doing much about it. But at least we're aware of that. What I'm talking about competes, in attention, horror with that, and there's everything else, inequality, racism, a dozen things. But this one is not in people's minds. So here we have this program, and I'll tell you what it is. The first step is, no first use of nuclear war, of nuclear weapons. Every president from Truman on, who remember, used nuclear weapons against a country that did not have them, we didn't call that first use, we were the only ones who could use it. That was true through 1949. When we built up our arsenal, we had close to 1,000 nuclear weapons for a first strike. They didn't call it a first strike because no one had the ability to have a second strike. But since Russia did include that, acquire that beginning in 49, since then, a threat of first use against Russia, which is coming up now, right now, in our exercises in Poland and elsewhere, is a threat against a superpower, which will cause nuclear winter. So it is a threat and a preparation for nuclear winter, which is actually risking that. Said, okay, we don't use nuclear weapons first. That's a declaration. Second, another one, I don't know if I remember all of them, but one is eliminate the hair trigger on our doomsday machine. And it would take too long, perhaps at this moment, to go into it, but I'll just say our intercontinental ballistic missiles are the hair trigger. We have submarine launched weapons, which are invulnerable and do not call for, even if we were attacked, they don't call for a fast response. They're invulnerable in the sea. The ICBMs, intercontinental, are in fixed silos, and they can survive an attack only if they get off the ground before the attack arrives.
So on warning, watch on warning. There have been many, many false alarm warnings. And some of them have gotten very serious, up to the point where the president was about to be urged to launch those ICBMs. We have no military reason for those ICBMs and haven't had for 50 years since both sides got submarine weapons. But they're Air Force weapons, bunch of Air Force budget. Boeing and Lockheed are now competing to get the contract for renewing all of our Minuteman missiles, which should not exist and shouldn't have existed for 50 years. So this is eliminate launch on warning, eliminate the air trigger. A third is cancel the $1.7 trillion modernization program. And fourth, another one is end the president's sole unchecked authority to launch nuclear war. Trump has put that into people's heads, actually, in a way that it wasn't before. But people have not yet realized entirely what I revealed in the book, which I revealed to John F. Kennedy and George Bundy back in 61. They didn't know it earlier. That Eisenhower had delegated that authority to theater commanders, and every president since then in the Cold War did the same, so that nobody could paralyze us by hitting Washington or SAC headquarters in Omaha or a few other places, rather widely delegated, secretly. Meaning that it isn't just a president's finger on the button, though it is on the button and nobody can check it. A lot of fingers are on the button. Okay, so trying to change that, and finally, get into negotiations for mutual, verifiable arms reductions with the Soviets, the Russians now, which are not being conducted at all now. They were conducted under every president since, I guess, Kennedy, and Eisenhower actually got into it earlier. Bogan, there are no such negotiations going on now. So we should negotiate. Very good points. PreventNuclearWar.org. What amazed me when I looked at that, and this was just weeks ago, I didn't know of it, was that this thing having started just last year, it really got going last month in August, a month ago, and it has the endorsement of the Unitarian Church nationally, the Presbyterian Church nationally, the LA City Council unanimously, the State Assembly, Senate and House of California. That was amazing to me to read that. And the American, the Conference of American Mayors, 1,400 mayors. Wow, I haven't seen anything like this since the freeze. And I will say, as a start of getting this into public attention more widely, San Francisco has to have it, San Diego, maybe not the first to do that, but I live in Berkeley. How come Berkeley hasn't done this yet, and so forth? Everybody can help to get that. And the advantage of that is that it's an educational process. Most of those points people don't even realize are problems. Why should you do this? What's the cost of not doing this, and so forth? This is wonderful, and I would like to see an effort by 2020 that this is, for the first time ever, an issue in a presidential campaign. It has not been an issue all that time. And it should be, remember, nothing like this was mentioned in any debates you've seen in 2016, 8, 4, any of those. So that should happen. I would have said a month ago the chance of that was very negligible, hardly worth it. I don't think that now. It's not going to be a feature in the 2018 elections, but in 2 years, with this kind of effort, it could be that we're at least discussing what needs to be done on this. And that is the most hopeful thing I've felt for years.
Well, thank you for writing the book and helping to push that along. Let's shift now to a discussion of your relationship with Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, two of the most well-known whistleblowers other than yourself, probably, in U.S. history. How do their actions compare with yours? How do you see what they're doing in relation to what you did?
Well, I was asked it the other night here in the room, and I gave my answer, which I can give you, but I realized that behind that question, a lot of people think that there's a big difference between these, me and these people. They will say, I was selective, and many of us were selective, I was skilled in knowing what to put out, and so forth, and they just dumped material out. That's why they believe. And Chelsea Manning, earlier Bradley Manning, and Ed Snowden are not widely well-regarded, actually, in the country, in part because of misconceptions like that. I'll get to that in just a moment. I'll say my feeling is from the very beginning, with Chelsea Manning in 2010, was I've waited 39 years for this, for somebody to put out a large amount of information that should be out, not just leaking one or two pages or orally talking about it, or 10 pages, but putting it out enough to show real patterns and real policy choices. For example, quickly handing over, she revealed, hundreds of cases where soldiers complained that the prisoners they were being ordered to hand over to the Iraqis were going to be tortured, and were tortured, and they were concerned about them. And in every single case, they were told by their superiors, do not investigate further. Four words, do not investigate further. Now that happens to be an illegal order. Our international treaties and our domestic law demand that any credible instance of torture must be investigated and prosecuted and found to be valid. That pattern was clearly represented, high-level decision going up to the president. And the president at that time was Barack Obama. This was in 2010, which I think has something to do with getting a 30-year sentence for putting this stuff out. But what I'm saying is, that's a pattern that could only be revealed by putting out a large amount of data. 10 pages would not show it. There are other instances of that too. So when I heard that she had said to the person who informed on her and got her in prison, very late, on a chat log, I am ready to go to prison for life or even be executed to put this information out. And I read that and I thought, that's the way I felt in 1969, 1971. And I haven't seen anybody else who said that ever since. And I thought that the example of the Pentagon Papers should encourage not a lot of people, people don't want to be tried for 115 years in prison. It's understandable. But somebody, Pentagon Papers turned out to be helpful. I didn't even go to prison by miracle. And so we encouraged other people to do it, but it didn't happen until 2010. Then, 3 years later, Ed Snowden puts out, each of them putting out an enormous mass, which I couldn't have done with only a Xerox machine, and I couldn't have done what I did without a Xerox machine. That was 7,000 pages. These were 700,000 pages. So they were putting that out. So, in short, these are people that could hardly be more different from me in background or age. They were very young. Chelsea was about 22 or 23 when he did it. He did it. Now, Chelsea. Ed Snow's about 28. Very different backgrounds altogether. But their motives, their willingness to risk their lives. She ends up 7.5 years in prison, 10.5 months in solitary, Ed Snowden, permanent exile. His father told me he doesn't want him to come back to this country even if he were pardoned, because he thinks he'd be killed by somebody. Definitely in jeopardy in his life, for his life. Willing to do that, I saw them, I identified more with them than any other people. And I had a tremendous thrill just a week ago of being able to meet Chelsea for the first time, meeting the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I was so happy at that because I had waited 8 years for it. She was in prison 7.5 years, and from the time she was arrested, not one till she got up, not one reporter was able to have 5 minutes with her. Totally incommunicado, in the outside world. Snowden saw that example and thought, well, same here, you know, if I do that, I can't be in the country if I want to educate reporters as to the meaning of these documents that I'm putting up. And that was true. We had to be out of this country, I believe, entirely. So, the last point I was saying, people say they were so different because they just dumped stuff out. I knew better than that from the beginning about that. Actually, Obama was asked at one point, early on, after she'd been arrested, didn't Bradley Manning do, this is on YouTube, you can look it up, Obama and Bradley Manning. Didn't Bradley Manning do exactly what Daniel Ellsberg did? And Obama said, what Ellsberg did was classified on a different basis from Bradley Manning. And that was true. Everything I put out was top secret. Everything she put out was secret, or less, or top secret. And same with Snowden. Snowden put out stuff that was top secret. But when I talked to her to confirm something that I'd always known, I had inferred, and I was able to check with her just 2 weeks ago, I read right away that she was that she had worked in Iraq in a SCIF, S-C-I-F. Now, how many people in this large audience know what a SCIF is? Let me see again. Oh, hi, can you see? I see maybe 20 hands, all right? How many do not know? Okay, so you're tracking it. Yeah. So, I know what a SCIF was. A SCIF is a special compartmented information facility, which is for material higher than top secret. That's what it's for. And it requires clearances. It can be, you can have 3, 10, a dozen, or more clearances higher than top secret. I had a dozen. The lowest of those is for communications intelligence, higher than top secret. And then satellite reconnaissance, covert operations, all that. So I asked her, didn't you have access to top secret? She only put out secret. Top secret, communications intelligence, she did everything. We had all that. She didn't put any of that out. Talk about selective. She put out stuff that was so low, I won't go into the details here, but I'll just say, it was so low that when I was in the Pentagon, I didn't take time to read anything that I didn't have time to read it. And frankly, when I read about all the torture and all the assassination she was reporting and all the other things, I thought, wow, maybe I missed something during the Pentagon. Except that stuff had become so normal and ordinary that it was now at a secret level, when in my day that would have been top secret or higher for that stuff. But now it's routine since 9/11. So in short, each of them were enormously selective. And despite the charges by Michael Hayden and others, the CIA, they have blood on their hands. Not one instance of physical harm to anybody was able to come up. And as she confirmed to me just last week, in the private courts, only the lawyers and the judge, I asked, did they come up with any instance of harm? Zero. Nothing. And nothing was reported publicly. So it could have been harmful, could have been harmful for me too, but it wasn't. And that reflected their selectivity in what they put out. So in short, they are heroes of mine. If that is not contradictory to my saying I also identify with them, I can say they acted in the way I wish I'd acted much earlier when I was their age. And they represent to me my best self.
You're talking about this earlier. We were talking about this earlier, the problem of moral courage. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit about why you think more people don't do this.
Why what?
Why more people don't do what you did.
Yeah. A, I don't know. That's a short answer. But I'm not known for short answers. I could stop at that. I have puzzled over that for a long time. Because as I said a moment ago, I did, obviously, you put out information like this in any organization, union, faculty, corporation, only at risk if I'm talking about information of a whistleblowing kind where you were revealing wrongdoing or disastrous or dangerous activity by your own organization, which is covering up and which is unwilling to deal with it. And so you put it out to a larger society, people who can change the situation in ways that your bosses are not willing to do. Bosses don't like that. And even in principle, even if it doesn't work in directly, they don't want things happen. And you do that always at risk. And if you identify it or identify yourself at cost, almost virtually always at cost, and you can't eliminate that, that will always be true in human society across the board. And so there are these costs to pay that are very significant in many cases. Still, the benefit of doing it to other people may be very large. In fact, I would go so far as to say this in 2018. I would now say, unless there are a lot of lives at stake, or the Constitution is at stake, as with Snowden, unconstitutional behavior, surveilling all America, the Fourth Amendment being wiped out. Unless there are very large stakes, the cost will rarely be worth it from a personal point of view. I wouldn't even encourage it. But there are times when there are a lot of lives at stake. And yet, people don't do it. I've mentioned three people, well, two besides myself here, who put out a lot of material, enough to make a real difference, perhaps. No guarantee that it will at all. Not clear that Chelsea's revelations hadn't made any difference. A lot of discussion of Ed Snowden's revelations of surveillance, but not yet clear that it's changed the situation at all. In my own case, the Pentagon Papers, it's a complicated case, but really the effect on the war of the information I put out was nothing immediately. A year after the Pentagon Papers came out, while on trial, the biggest bombing of the war, in fact, the biggest bombing in human history, in 72, and the Christmas bombing of 72. Not apparent that there had been any effect at all. Turns out there was, but that didn't become clear until much later. So you have to be, if you're going to do this, you've got to be willing to take risks without any real assurance that it will have any effect. It just might have on a very big effect. And you ask how to get more. Somebody asked me that yesterday at the meeting. And the only thing that came to my mind was I said, examples are very important. I know in my own case, crucial. Without the example, if I hadn't met in September of, actually the end of August, September of 1969, young Americans who were on their way to prison for having protested the war, resisted the war by turning in their draft cards. And not one of them thought they were going to end the war or shorten the war by turning in their draft cards. But they wanted to send the strongest message they could. The war was wrong. You shouldn't participate in it, even as a CEO, they felt, or by going to Sweden, you shouldn't, or you should be willing to go to prison to show that it's a conscience matter and it's worth your life, your freedom, to protest it or to resist it. And I felt the power of that on my own life. It changed my life. That put the question in my head, what could I do to help shorten the war, which I've been trying to do for 2 years at that point, as an insider, having come back from Vietnam. I dealt with Humphrey and Bobby Kennedy, and even representatives of Romney, if you remember him, Romney's father, Richard Romney, and who was against the war at that point, got fired for it, as head of HEW. And he was at the presidential candidate, in fact. I talked to his people, and a bunch of others. But as an insider, which didn't risk my career, nobody thought of risking their career. Why would you give up a career of advising cabinet members, having access to these documents, working for the president? What could possibly be more effective than that? And here were these people going to prison. And I thought, okay, what can I do now to help shorten the war, now that I'm ready to go to prison. And I would have thought that, I think, if I hadn't met them personally, Randy Keeler specifically, who was on his way to prison, and I just heard him talking. He was from Harvard, as I had been. I saw myself as a young man in him. He was now at Stanford doing graduate work, and then he became a draft resistor and did go to prison for a couple of years. Had I not met Randy Keeler, it would not have occurred to me to do something that I thought would not only erase my career, my parents, my exit, but I thought would put me in prison for the rest of my life. So for what that was worth, without that example, it wouldn't have occurred to me to do it. I was very happy to hear Ed Snowden say, from Moscow on a Skype link, without Ellsberg, no Snowden. And what he was referring to was the movie, the documentary, Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers, which he said strengthened his idea that he really should do what he ended up doing. He was ready to do it. Chelsea, I think, did not have that particular person on her own. But very happy to hear that Snowden done that. So I think that the example is important. And what else? I think we have to change a culture, political culture, that puts the very highest value on obedience to the boss, on keeping the secrets of the team, keeping your promise to keep secrets of the team, not your oath to the Constitution, which is far away. I don't think anybody has ever been put on trial for violating their oath to the Constitution, which we all took as an oath to support and defend the Constitution, not to the Fuhrer, not to the President, not to secrecy, but to support and defend the Constitution. And in 1964, during the election of 64, every one of us in the Pentagon knew the President was violating the Constitution when he was lying to Congress about his intention to expand the war. All of us. And it didn't occur to anybody to do something that would undermine the President in favor of Goldwater. But even Republicans didn't do that. By the way, Goldwater knew he was at the chops of this weapon. And Goldwater, who was an Air Force Major General Reserve, on the Armed Services Committee and a presidential candidate, said, if I revealed that the President was lying about that, who would have believed me? Now, interesting, he didn't make the check. He didn't try in the campaign to say that Johnson is lying when he says he wouldn't widen the war, which I knew he was lying, and Goldwater knew. But Johnson then wins an unprecedented landslide on election day, having said, we seek no wider war, I will send American boys to do what Vietnamese boys should be doing, etc. And on election day, I wasn't voting, I was representing the Defense Department as a GS-18, in an interagency group to examine different options of widening the war. We didn't have time to wait till the next day, because the Saigon regime was collapsing every few weeks. We didn't have time for that. And we didn't do it the day before because it might have leaked. And the voters would have found that quite relevant if they believed it. So that's what we were doing. In short, I was learning something about the government, our government. What I.F. Stone said, all government officials lie, all governments, and nothing they say is to be believed. But this is my experience of it now, in real time, watching this happen, and I was part of it. And I did not believe it, and it didn't occur to me to do it. Well, all I'm saying is, we could begin, I can imagine training people that there are occasions when you should risk your job to tell the truth. We aren't trained for that. Nobody is trained for that. And somebody suggested to me just the other day for the first time, the exception, union organizers are trained to risk their jobs. Interesting. Nobody else, you could say. And when you say moral courage, you say, that's what we're talking about. Risking ostracism, risking losing your immediate associations, threatening your career, your income, your ability to send your children to college, and all that. Perhaps you're married, very good. By doing something that will isolate you in order to say, quote, others, strangers, people outside your immediate we group, between us. And in a way, that brings us back to the very first point you raised, which I wasn't expecting, the mention of the indigenous people. What I've come to learn at 87, it's very bitter learning, I would say, is this. It's everyone understands, as humans, that we don't actually love our neighbor or our neighbor's children as we love ourselves or our spouses or our own children as much. That is a council of perfection, let's say, that doesn't even seem human somehow. Not even mean neighbors, but say strangers altogether. We have different we groups, us versus them. Very human dichotomy, which is universal. I don't think we'll ever get away from that. Dichotomizing and dichotomy. Us and them, the strangers. We don't value the lives of the other outside these areas as much as the inner children. Okay. We basically know that. Here's the bitter truth. That I have, it's taken me to old age. I am old. And to understand, for most, I would say almost all people, there is an other outside certain concentric circles here in Vermont. But we don't just value less, we don't value them at all. Their welfare means nothing. Extermination, we may or may not, we can easily be convinced that those are enemies or people beneath contempt that deserve extermination, but we don't always think that. More commonly, I would say, there are others that it just doesn't matter what happens to them. And the idea of 600 million people or a billion people or nuclear war, we risk it, we prepare it, we risk it, and as humans, really doesn't bother us. And I don't see that. I can imagine changing that. Maybe. I don't know if it's possible. Certainly the circle of concern can be broadened. That happens a lot. And you can train that and get it. But there's always a little behind that that is, my friend Noam Chomsky puts it, that are like ants. We take no trouble to stop, to avoid stepping. Janes do, actually. Sweet before, but other people don't. And that's the way it is. Could we possibly change that? And the reason for really trying to change it is now we endanger all of them in a way that we didn't before. We, in particular in this country and in Russia, we have these doomsday machines that are absolutely unconscionable. And it isn't even generally an issue that we are risking the world. Reagan said, nuclear war, Gorbachev, nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. Very good. Each of them went ahead with arms races after saying that as before, until a certain point. And we're still doing it. He didn't say nuclear war between the US and Russia, which threatens everyone on Earth, not only can't be won, it can't be survived, it must not be risked, or prepared for, or threatened. He didn't say that because he didn't believe it. We threaten it, we risk it, we prepare it. We shouldn't do that. And it is possible, I would aim, I said it related to your first point. We don't regard anybody the way I was raised in the Saturday morning movies to regard Indians as people that really don't matter, and wounded me or whatever, and actually are enemies that need exterminating. There shouldn't be anybody like that, and there is not. So we have to change. We have to be better. But where we are now as a country and as a species is not good enough. It's got to be better. not acceptable, it's not good enough, and it's heading for near extinction. And I think the chance of changing that against the influence of people, corporations, and governments that have an interest in preparing doomsday, in the jobs, in the profits, in the protection racket we give to alliances and everything else, they have an interest in it. They have great influence on our media and our Congress, and they consider themselves bought Congress. And we've got to have a Congress that is not bought by arms makers or other merchants of death or merchants of honor side of here. That will be a different one from the current one. Now, we need it. The chance of getting it is not likely. It's small. But it can be made larger, and that's what I'm up to. That's what my life is about.
Thank you. Why don't we open this up now for questions? We'd like to privilege students. When Professor Aslan and I were talking about this event earlier, there's hope that